You may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. I apologize. For some reason, the top part of the notes of my argument did not print. They think they were largely about where the issues regarding the jail attire were preserved. They're in there. There's a point where the trial court does ask, are you comfortable?
Do you need less time to argue then?
We'll see. If the trial court says, do you object to being tried in jail clothes? He says somewhat. Further along is when the Commonwealth points out they want tried in jail attire. He says, objection. They only ask for shackles. I'll point out.
Object to the shackles.
And I'll point that out now. I'm not talking about shackles. He didn't object. I didn't raise it. We're talking about.
But that's kind of the question I have. The purpose of preventing somebody from being forcibly tried in jail attire is to prevent the jurors knowing that the person is in jail and whatever prejudice might attach to that. But he didn't object to being in shackles, and doesn't being in shackles convey the same message to the juror?
It's common sense, Your Honor. We need courts of common sense, but in a court of law, we're bound by it. I'd start with Estelle versus Williams.
What about when you combine him being in shackles willingly with him wanting the jury to know that he's been incarcerated while the proceedings have been going on?
Your Honor.
And he tells them that in voir dire.
And it's interesting. We come back to that in voir dire, too, and I have the Commonwealth point that out, too, as far as, and I can't remember at what point did he say that, are you going to be prejudiced by seeing me in jail attire? Was that before or after he said, you know, I've been incarcerated for this long,
doesn't he then editorialize and say that because I've been in jail for the last year on this?
Right, he tries to point out the guidelines. See, that comes out in the voir dire issue. So, but I'd submit he's already been compelled. The damage has been done. Now he's asking the jury, which is a separate issue I'll come back to about that. But as far as the law governing the case, I think we start with Estelle versus Williams, which does distinguish between the effect of shackles and the effect of jail attire. And whatever common sense might dictate, of course.
Doesn't that indicate that the shackles are worse than jail attire?
What it indicates is that shackles...
Dangerousness.
Right. Shackles indicate necessity. I mean, that they can be justified on a case-by-case basis, given whether it can be established that there's a need for that. And I've not even raised the shackles. I don't think we need to get into the need.
I think we do, because even if we agree with you that he was compelled, and I'm not sure I do, but even if we do agree that he was compelled to appear in jail attire, we still would have to do a harmless error analysis. And it would be a constitutional harmless error, but you know, if he's in shackles, like you said, it's pretty common sense that he's in custody.
I believe so, Your Honor, but Estelle versus Williams, I think, does lay out the difference between the two. I would submit there has to be some other reason articulated to justify the compulsion to appear in jail attire. Because it does not contribute to security. It furthers no state purpose, as the case says. Compulsion, the court did bring up. The Commonwealth asked that he be tried in jail attire, and the court granted. That's compulsion. They didn't cite any reason for it. They had the deputy testify that the deputy wouldn't be comfortable. Again, no reason provided for it. There was reasons provided for the restraints because he had incidents in the jail.
Actually, the Commonwealth erroneously thought they had compelled him. Like, wasn't the jail attire issue was left out of the motion, or am I getting that mixed up?
No, that's correct. The written motion said shackles only. Then they arrive in court, and the Commonwealth says jail attire. That's when he objects. No, it's not in the motion. He's right.
Yeah.
It's not in the motion. It comes up for the first time. But
did the court ask him whether or not he had any street clothes lined up?
I believe that did come up, and I think he said something about, like, he didn't know he could do that. That may be an issue, but when we're talking about compulsion, again, I'd submit if it's requested by the Commonwealth, granted by the court, that's compulsion.
His objection is somewhat. Do you object somewhat? Is that a legal objection? Does that alert the court to what the objection is and why it should be sustained?
I'd submit if the court doesn't find that, when he says objection, when the Commonwealth brings up jail attire, they didn't bring up jail attire before, I'd submit that's going to preserve the issue for the court's review.
So can you elaborate a little bit on because I thought you said this at the writ panel argument too, that the Commonwealth Attorney's Office here requested that he wear jail attire or pressed that he wear jail attire.
The record should be clear about that, Your Honor, especially when that comes up. And they said, you know, we want him in jail attire, although he said they didn't put in their written motion. They called the deputy saying, why should he be in jail attire? This was their request from the beginning.
This was Leslie Green's request.
I would submit the record is clear about that. He never asked for it. That's for sure. It's clear that he didn't want to be in jail attire, but he wanted to be in shackles. One of the few things that doesn't make sense about this case. But I'll take a moment to address Wilkins, because that does put the burden on us to establish that jail attire was clearly identifiable. I'd submit the judge says you object to being tried in jail attire. Put on this issue about the evidence about why he should be in jail attire. Sheriff says, I want him in jail attire. He asked the jury, are you biased by seeing me in jail attire? So there is no description on the record, but I'd submit the court can easily infer from the record that that's been established. I'd submit that under the circumstances, when can somebody be compelled to appear in jail clothing? And I think the law does...
Why is it compulsion if the judge asks him and is trying to inquire as to why he's doing this? You know, it seems like the judge is concerned, at least. Wants to make sure he's aware that he doesn't have to wear jail clothes as long as he makes arrangements to get some other clothes.
And I think the judge was definitely doing his duty with a pro se defendant, that's for sure.
Did the defendant ask for a continuance?
I'm sorry?
Did the defendant ask for a continuance, so it's the subject of him not having jail clothing, not having street clothing was brought up?
I'm not aware that he asked for continuance, Your Honor, but I would submit that once the Commonwealth said we want him in jail attire and the court granted the motion, that's probably going to be the end of it. I'd submit a continuance or any relief at that point is not going to be granted. We have the compulsion.
Well, at that point, they want him in jail clothing because he doesn't have street clothing and they're ready to go with the trial.
Your Honor, with all due respect, I don't think that's what the record reflects. I think, and we look at the witness the Commonwealth called, the idea was to point out that he's a security threat, therefore he should be in jail attire and shackles. The law supports shackles, not jail attire. So I'd submit they have compelled.
Jail attire, wearing a jumpsuit as opposed to anything else, doesn't alter the security threat when he's come out of the holding cell.
Exactly, Your Honor. That's why it's two different standards.
Well, why wouldn't the jail attire be a security issue if he were to escape? The purpose of the orange jumpsuit is to make him highly visible.
Your Honor, again, I go.
Not a security issue.
I go back to Estelle on that. I mean, the Estelle case does point out the jail attire does not further a state interest. I don't think they point out he's likely to run. They need to track him down. And it's a badge of guilt before the juries, which I think is supposed to outweigh any sort of state interest it could possibly further. There may be some. Maybe there is an escape possibility, but I'd submit that under Estelle versus Williams, we see the balancing test. It's outweighed by the prejudice against the jury. I'll point out the Commonwealth raised harmless error in all three issues, so I'll point out how do we know a jury wasn't influenced by this. If he'd been allowed to dress like a lawyer, for example, he did give a statement about how he had potentially a defense of duress or self-defense or necessity or what have you. How do they know they wouldn't have believed him if he could have dressed differently? How do we know his sentence wouldn't have been different if for no other reason that he's up there dressed?
Well, I think the harmless error analysis is not how do we know, but it's rather more along the lines of the jury knew he was incarcerated because of the shackles and because he told him so. So what difference does it make whether he was wearing jail clothes?
It does come back to how do we know, Your Honor. How do we know that didn't influence the jury? I mean, it's got to be beyond reasonable doubt for harmless error. So regarding the video, that's a relatively brief portion of the argument. The trial court did have discretion over what relief to grant. Mr. Munford did claim that he wanted to view this video before trial. It's similar to the Bell case, of course. That's when the person had a third attorney after two prior attorneys. The Commonwealth didn't have to provide it to the third attorney. It would be an interesting case if, for example, he comes to trial. He had an attorney at the time and says his attorney didn't show it to him. His attorney says, well, may I actually get a continuance? That's my fault. Now, in the Bell case, of course, the argument was that the evidence should therefore be inadmissible. There's other cases before court, too. Marino saying discovery can be disclosed mid-trial. I didn't bring up the Tuma case, but I believe that's another case where the court pointed out you didn't even ask for a continuance. You didn't ask for a recess to view the video.
Didn't the Supreme Court reverse Tuma? Are you talking about our Tuma?
I know it's come up, and it's come up in some other cases as well. Just you didn't even ask for continuance to look at the video. And I think that's all Mr. Munford wanted. So he wasn't asking the video.
He ultimately was represented by counsel at trial, and the counsel was familiar with the video and, in fact, elicited cross-examination about the video.
And, Your Honor, then we have to get to the effect
of... Is that accurate?
That's accurate, Your Honor.
So how is that not harmless if, in fact, it's error?
Well, again, the question is if Mr. Munford had a chance to view the video, because the problem is we didn't have counsel through the trial, and that's another unusual factor for this case. He's doing it pro se with counsel on standby. Then counsel steps in. He was in during the time the video was played.
If we analyze this as we would if this were an attorney, and we hold pro se litigants to the same standards, this is a request for discovery. in effect.
Correct, Your Honor.
Which has to be made 10 days prior to trial. This was the motion that was received by the trial court was received 4 days before his jury trial. So it is late.
That's correct, Your Honor. I don't think the record disputes that. You know, again, he's not saying that the Commonwealth should be barred from using it. I'd submit all he's saying is he just wanted to take a moment to view the video and think go forward with the trial. That's all he wanted. It is a discretion issue. It is reviewed for abuse of discretion.
Asking for a continuance so he could view the video and plan his defense.
Your Honor, I think that's one possible form of relief he could have requested.
Isn't that what he did request?
And if he did, Your Honor, that's one, you know, again, it's trial court discretion about whether to grant him that or grant him the chance to view the video, whether he wanted the trial postponed or just to step out.
Which is it, though?
Your Honor, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head which one he wanted. I know he just wanted to view the video. He didn't want to render the video inadmissible. He wanted to view the video. And as far as whether the court had discretion, I'd submit the court could have allowed him to view the video. The court said he gets no relief at all. And I'd submit that's an abuse of discretion.
He did get to view the video at trial.
He viewed it once played at trial.
And he made no further motion or request pointing out that why that was his failure to see it beforehand prejudiced him.
He didn't bring that up. He didn't articulate it in particular, but I would submit
his
that.
His counsel at the time the video was played was not standby, was full on counsel.
Correct.
Had viewed the video during the course of discovery, was familiar with it, and was in fact able to utilize that familiarity to cross-examine witnesses.
It is correct, Your Honor. And then, of course, Mr. Munford, at the time, of course, he's asking for this. He hasn't brought his counsel back in. So, again, addressing the harmless issue, you know, how we know if he had a chance to see the video, he could have prepared differently. He would have asked his counsel to come in. I've got about 20 seconds left for my third issue before getting to rebuttal. I hate to say this, but I would point out that I'm not sure if a lawyer had asked this question about the jail attire and experience with police officers, if it would have come up, if it would have been disallowed, if this court would have upheld that. But we come to where we fall between Juniper and the Lawler case more recently. I'm getting a rebuttal, but I'll point it out here. Juniper, of course, points out basically that if a question in voir dire goes toward relationship, interest, opinion, or prejudice, the 8.01-358 factors, it must be permitted. Then, of course, we have Lawler, which says that the judge can determine whether the defendant has had the opportunity to elicit the responses. So where do we fall in that standard? I'd submit the judge, I think, basically asked, are you biased or prejudiced for any reason? But I would submit he has the opportunity to say, I'd submit these questions in particular. Are you going to be prejudiced by pre-seeing me in my jail clothes? Have you had bad experience with police officers? They are squarely on the facts of the statute. I'd submit that sort of thing the court ought to have permitted. The court didn't bring it up in its own question. Just, is there any reason? I think that's a dangerous precedent to just say, well, that's going to satisfy any further questions that...
I know you're in your boat, but I need to ask you this. I don't understand how that question would help him determine whether the juror had any potential bias in the case.
Which one?
The question about, have you ever been beaten by a law enforcement officer? I can see how the Commonwealth might ask that question, but I don't see how that establishes any bias against the defendant.
And I think there's general case law that the defendant has the right to ask about positive bias toward police officers. But we're talking about bias or prejudice, and the law doesn't state it has to be against the defendant. Whether it makes sense or not, I think that's where we are. So,
what does that have to do with the jail clothing?
Well, that's a separate question. That's a question in which he's saying, are you prejudiced by pre-seeing me? I would think it's a very dangerous precedent to say the trial court's question, are you biased for any reason, forecloses any further questions along those lines. The statute's case law, justice saying any issue may arise at trial, Powell.
Does he claim that hurt him?
I'm sorry?
But how does he claim that the denial of that question hurt him if the question wasn't reasonably calculated to help him to begin with?
We're talking about the police experience question?
Yes, sir.
Well, again, Your Honor, we don't know. I think that cuts to the harmless error issue. And again, I think there's a mention of that in the Commonwealth's brief.
But tell me how it's harmful error. How on your best day it's harmful error.
Well, as far as the bad experience of the police question, I'd submit again, if that elicited anybody that might have been necessary to strike for cause, you know, again, it may have been the Commonwealth that wanted to make the strike for cause.
Only people he would seek to strike would be people that hadn't been beaten by the police.
Which, again, I'd submit that if they can't stand a difference in the cause for one reason or another, and that's the defense he wanted to raise, it cuts to that. As far as the jail clothing, I'd submit that in the Commonwealth's brief it says that it's harmless because the judge already ordered the shackles and the jail attire. So I'd submit that doesn't change anything. That he has to appear in jail attire. Now he has to have jurors that are biased and can't stand a different cause because of the jail attire. So I'd submit that that question, if not the other one, should have been permitted, and ask court to reverse for those reasons.
Thank you, Mr. Osgood. We had a lot of questions for you, so I'll give you some rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Murphy.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. So Gene Murphy for the Commonwealth. Well, I was going to move quickly through the first point, but even on the objection, as Judge Petty has already pointed out, there was a problem. Because you asked, did this alert the court that, in fact, he was objecting? Well, it didn't, because if you read the court order memorializing what happened at this on this day, at page 235, the court says that Munford was asked about the jail attire and the shacklings and had no objection. So the court did not see this as an objection. And it's understandable because of the confusion raised about the last hearing. The judge had said, well, we're going to have the shackles removed from you because we don't want anybody to be biased by that. And the Mr. Munford says, no, I want the shackles. I love my shackles. I want the, you know, people to know that I'm wearing shackles. And this is part of his whole strategy of, you know, I'm being persecuted. And
do you agree that there was, for purposes of the analysis, state compulsion here?
No, no, not whatsoever. Defendant never asked to
but
be.
But that's that. It doesn't. The defendant doesn't have to ask if to not be enclosed. The question is, did the state compel him to appear enclosed? And the Commonwealth attorney requested it.
Well, there are two questions here. First of all, was he compelled without any reason? That is the usual case, that he's in.
Well, we start with compulsion and then we look for cause.
Right. Well, I mean, there are two issues here. First of all, was he compelled? If you determine he was compelled, then the issue is, was he properly compelled? Because they had a hearing on whether his behavior and his assaults at the jail justified his being placed in attire and shackles. So, I mean, he was compelled in that sense, although he didn't object to that order.
You don't think his statement, somewhat with his later common objection, or was sufficient?
Well, no, I don't believe it is, because as pointed out, the judge did not recognize that he had objected. He said no objection in his order. But more importantly, he didn't object to the evidence that required that he be held in shackles. He said, yes, I agree I should be in shackles because I would be a danger.
In fact, he objected to the removal of the shackles.
Yes, that's exactly true, Your Honor. And so the question is, he then argues, well, but I didn't agree to be in attire. But the Commonwealth moved in. It did not include jail attire in his written motion, but at the hearing, it incorporated that into the argument, had testimony given by the officer that both the jail attire and the shackles were necessary because of the dangers of the Mr. Munford had demonstrated.
The Commonwealth's attorney did request the jail attire as well as the shackles.
Yes, that's correct, Ron. And the judge found that she had done so and granted the motion with respect to that, and saying also at that point, without objection from the defendant. And I think the idea that somehow jail attire is doesn't help the security interests. I remember walking down Bank Street when the federal officers were delivering prisoners to the jail there, and they were wearing the old black and white striped outfits that you know never see anymore. And the obvious purpose there is if somebody's able to escape onto the street, he's running around in this kind of outfit. And the same thing applies with the orange uniform. I mean, that is one way of determining if somebody gets into a crowd, even if he still has shackles on, may be able to conceal that, but he won't be able to conceal that he's in jail attire.
Let me ask you about that voir dire. It's a little disconcerting that once the Commonwealth requires the defendant to appear in the jail attire, the defendant is not allowed to ask the jury whether it would have any impact on their verdict.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why was it proper for the trial court to disallow that question?
Because no question in this case that the jurors aren't prejudiced against the defendant. That's the whole point of the Estelle case. is that if somebody sees somebody in jail attire, he will, in fact, the jurors will be prejudiced.
A lawyer would stand up and say, my client is here wearing jail attire. You can see that. Would that have any impact on your verdict as to whether he committed this crime? Wouldn't that be a proper question?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the juror could not be struck if he responded affirmatively. Because the court and Estelle said...
If the juror said, absolutely, the fact that he's in jail and it means to me he's guilty, you couldn't strike that juror for cause?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because don't forget, what we have is a situation where he has been compelled to appear in shackles. And the jury is clearly going to be prejudiced by that, and that's why...
But the question is not whether they're prejudiced. The question is whether they would consider that in determining whether he's guilty or not. Would the fact that my client has been indicted lead you to believe that he's guilty? That's a proper question. It's a proper jury instruction.
Well, Your Honor, but I don't. I think what we have here is imputed prejudice. The whole purpose of the rule is that the jurors will be expected to be prejudiced. So what you're asking is...
But still be able to follow the evidence.
But could they put that prejudice beside...
Well, that's not the question. The question was, if you are prejudiced...
But if... What was the question... You wanted to ask the jury about, quote, the impact of his appearance in jail attire and their experience... No, that wasn't about it. I think the question was... I think it was basically, would you consider this... In determining guilt or innocence?
Well, the question actually was, are you biased by pre-seeing me in my previous attire of jail clothes?
Yes, yeah, I'm sorry.
And I think that the court imputes prejudice from that. That's the whole purpose of this rule. And when you have somebody who has been compelled because of his security concerns to be there, I mean, say that, well, yeah, I'm kind of biased. I mean, this guy apparently has been in prison. He's a danger. But that wouldn't permit a motion to strike without further questions about that. In fact, he would consider none of the evidence.
The statute, 8.01.358, dealing with voir dire, says you're allowed to ask questions to determine whether the jury has any interest in the cause or has expressed or formed any opinions or is sensible to any bias or prejudice therein.
Yes.
So if that's a basis for striking one for cause, that they are sensible to a bias or prejudice, why isn't asking them, are you prejudiced because I'm wearing jail attire? Why is that proper?
Because the jurors would be expected to respond yes. I mean, that's the problem here is that we have permitted prejudice to come into the case because the defendant...
So he shouldn't be able to take advantage of inviting that, essentially, by asking, yes, are you offended by this?
Well, he in fact has misbehaved. He admits that. He says, I'm a security risk. So they say, well, then you're going to have to appear in shackles and jail attire. And now he says, well, because I'm in jail attire, the jury's all prejudiced, they should all be struck. Is basically what it comes down to.
What if the proposed question was not as it had been proposed, but was in fact, would seeing me in jail attire render you unable to follow the law and the evidence in this case in reaching your verdict?
That might well be appropriate. I mean, the question is not are you prejudiced, but, have you heard anything about this case? Yes, I have. Will that affect your judgment? No, it won't. Same thing here. You feel some prejudice against me because of seeing me in shackles. And then it follows up and says, well, would that preclude your listening to the evidence and rendering a verdict based upon that evidence?
That's a $64 question.
Yes, Your Honor. I think all we have here is, are you prejudiced? And I think that doesn't get anywhere because anybody in the panel should have responded honestly, yes, according to the United States Supreme Court in Estelle, that this is not some automatic bias producer or prejudice producer. Because of the, here he is all, he's in shackles, he's being, shuffling around the courtroom. He must be a very dangerous man. And it would be surprising if the juror wasn't affected by that. I think that if you look at the scheme of the defendant's questioning, he wasn't really trying to answer, get any information from the jurors. He was trying to make his own case, asking questions. Because immediately after...
It's part of the trial strategy, argument that I'm being singled out here or persecuted.
Right. After the court refused the question on being beaten by law officers, the judge said, not relevant. He said, I was beat by officers. He also asked, well, does the jury know, does anyone bother by the fact that I'm being tried without having seen any of the evidence? Or that does the jury know that I have been held in custody for almost a year? I mean, this is part of his defense, that he is somehow being railroaded.
Was all this done in the presence of the jury?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the jury heard the questions?
So these are the voir dire questions.
They just weren't allowed to answer the questions.
That's correct, Your Honor. But in fact, he was providing information to them, as he did, I think, also when he took the stand and gave substantial...
Some of it phrased in the form of a question, some of it just pure editorialization.
Yes, Your Honor. Then, in fact, he was getting this before the court.
Arguably but, similar to the strategy of deciding to represent yourself to be the little guy that's been picked on and beaten up by law enforcement against the big old government.
Right. So I think even if there were anything wrong with this question, we'd have a harmless error issue even on the voir dire. No serious claim that this made a difference to the outcome of the trial. There was absolutely no defense for the suspended, the driving on suspended.
It would be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, since it's got to be constitutional harmless.
Yes, sir.
Right. Harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because he's in the shackles anyway and he didn't object to that. Is that part of it? Or?
That part of it, and also the fact that even on the eluding, there is absolutely no evidence that he fled for any reason than the reason he gave when he was stopped.
Let me clarify something. The voir dire issue, that's not a constitutional harmless issue.
No, Your Honor.
Yeah.
But the only...
The tail would be.
Yes. The eluding, the no explanation whatsoever, a credible explanation, was why he fled. Other than what he said when they were actually stopped. And he said, I fled because I was driving on a suspended license. He then said, I also wanted to get back to Richmond or Petersburg. I didn't want to be locked up in a jail in Hick County. So that means that was clear that he knew he was going to be arrested because he was driving on a suspended. So he decided, I'm trying to get away. If I can't get away, at least I'll get closer to civilization, in his terms, so that it seems clear that any of the errors, where any error in this case, would be harmless. Unless there are any further questions, I'll simply request that the decision below be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. Mr. Eisner, I'm going to give you, I'll give you 3 minutes of rebuttal because we had a lot of questions for you.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. There's only a couple of brief points I want to bring up on the issue of the compulsion jail tire. Connell's referenced the court order, which says that there are no objections made by a defendant. The court has the record before it, so I'd submit the fact that the trial court's order was wrong. It's not unpreserved the issue that was still made to the trial court. The other thing I'll bring up is talking about the compulsion for jail tire. The only grounds I can find in the law as far as when compulsion to wear jail tire is appropriate is if it reveals information that the jury already knows, like it's a murder by an inmate trial or it's a sentencing. It can be a strategic decision by defense counsel. The request not to wear jail tire can be made in bad faith. I think besides that, there's really no other situation where it's considered appropriate. That's all I have.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Eisner.